You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This is a show about peace, promoting it, preserving it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. A war against Iraq seemed closer today as Washington disparaged Baghdad's weapons declaration and London acknowledged deploying an aircraft carrier and additional chartered ships to augment the 40,000 British troops already in the region. Today's action follows reports earlier this week that Turkish and American troops and equipment entered the Kurdish-controlled region of northern Iraq. Robert Knight, Peace Watch producer from WBAI Pacifica Station in New York City, has more in this report.
Even as Iraqi expatriates gathered in London to piece together a post-Saddam government for Iraq, American and Turkish operatives were in heated negotiations with Kurdish dissidents under the northern no-fly zone, according to Middle East Report associate editor Ian Urbina, who identified the main Kurdish elements now plotting against Baghdad with the U.S. and Turkey.
There are two main parties. First is the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which is the KDP. And the second is the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which is the PUK. And those are the two main organizations that are working that have foot soldiers and are working with the U.S. and Great Britain. There is a third party on the ground in Kurdistan, which could complicate things once the U.S. invades, and that's the Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK. Their numbers are significantly diminished in the last several years, but they're a staunchly pro-independence party, and they are not privy to the collaboration going on presently, but they do have well-armed soldiers on the ground in northern Iraq.
The Turkish history of suppressing Kurdish culture adds irony to the current collaboration.
Essentially, the Turkish government, with U.S. help, cut a deal with the two main Kurdish leaders, Talabani and Barzani. What the terms of that deal are, no one really knows. I imagine it's most likely some recognition of mild autonomy post-Saddam.
Urbina is doubtful that the Kurds have surrendered oil rights in their northern Iraqi enclaves near the Kurdish shrines of Kirkuk and Erbil. But what the Kurds would do for Washington is provide their guerrilla forces as shock troops and reconnaissance agents to shield American troops from harm in the early days of a war in Iraq.
The quid pro quo was probably you provide us with the intelligence and the guides and some of the frontline bullet catchers who go in first and run the highest risk of getting gassed or getting hit with whatever chemical or bio weapon Saddam has. And in return, we will allow you and help you negotiate a presence in post-Hussein Iraq and the government that takes place. Again, what level of presence the U.S. might have offered the Kurds in that, it's really hard to say. On the other hand, I think the Kurdish parties had the upper hand in those negotiations with the U.S. because they know the region better than anyone. And so, to a large extent, the U.S. had to use them.
The current Kurdish negotiations came as the United States tried to forge a grand coalition with other Iraqi dissidents who attended a recent meeting in London.
The purpose of the London meeting, which just recently finished up, was really more than anything to attempt to do away with the image of these opposition groups as, you know, bickering siblings. And to some extent, it pulled it off. In other extents, it backfired for the U.S. For example, one of the few things that all these different factions could agree on was that they didn't want the U.S., and this was a U.S.-sponsored meeting, that they didn't want the U.S. running Baghdad after Saddam, and they did not support a U.S. occupation like the U.S. has been talking about. The organization that's playing its hand most forcefully, partially because it's got U.S. backing, is the INC, the Iraqi National Congress, in Chalabi. Unfortunately, his Achilles heel is that he really doesn't have the on-the-ground backing of any, you know, in presence within Iraq, as different from, for example, the Kurdish factions or the Shiite representative. They actually have support of factions that are on the ground in Iraq.
The London summit of Iraqi dissidents vowed to reconvene and enter the Kurdish portion of Iraq on January 15th of 2003. Ian Urbina is the associate editor of the Middle East Report, which is published by the Middle East Research and Information Project based in Washington, D.C. And in New York, I'm Robert Knight.
From the prisons of California, a plea for peace and hope. Within his prison cell on death row, philosopher, former Crips founder, gang member, and children's author, and Nobel Peace Prize nominee, Stanley Tukey Williams offers a chilling lesson of hope to America.
I mean, to believe that murder is the solution for our problems or war is the solution for our problems, that's insane. You can't establish peace and think that it can be maintained by means of aggression. In essence, it's an indictment of our own hypocrisy. Peace can't be extorted, intellectualized, or peddled like a commodity. That's an illusion.
What, in your vision, what is peace?
That's a pretty good question. I mean, well, let's just say peace is a bold concept. It's a subjective concept that I consider to be based on MOT. That's M-A-A-T. It's a comedic term for truth, justice, and righteousness. And believe me, it's not for the faint of heart, the warmonger, nor the charlatan. I mean, the fact of the matter is, peace has to be developed within. History has shown us that without inner peace, people will tend to violate a truth, break promises, or extend an olive branch with one hand while holding a weapon in the other.
How do you go from taking that internal peace that cultivates within you and applying it to your world?
It becomes a natural process. I've always told individuals that peace in itself is like a link to God, in a sense. It's a connection. You know, you have that aura about you that no one can take away. So you become, in a sense, fearless. It's all about how I project myself through peace. And beautiful part of it is anybody can embrace it.
In your books, how do you offer children visions of peace?
The books in itself is, I consider it to be more of a caveat, something to warn children about, because I've experienced this madness and I know what they're heading for if they end up traveling down the path that I have. Throughout those books, I warn them about gangs, I warn them about drugs, weapons, and things of that nature. And my main objective is for them to obtain an education, because once they start going to a juvenile hall, they'll end up being in CYA, then prison, then before they know it, they'll end up on death row, like a lot of these youngsters are. So it's more of a warning that this isn't the type of life they want to experience. Actually, it is no life being in prison.
How do you find peace in the state penitentiary? How do you find peace where you're at today?
Well, it's not something that is external. I have to find it. It's within. I establish my own peace through prayers and reading, writing children's books. I find it when I exercise. I find peace. I receive a visit when I'm talking to people that I love over the phone, things of that nature. It's something that has to come from within. And the fact of the matter is unless, you know, a person can develop peace within, believe me, you can't experience it with anyone else.
How do you think the government or, say, like state or local laws contribute to the lack of peace in urban settings?
There's nothing out there that, in a sense, exemplifies hope. I mean, where there is hopelessness, there will be chaos and murder and other forms of pandemonium. So it's a lack of many things out there, lack of adequate schools, things of that nature. So there are many contributing factors that helps to perpetuate the madness out there in Oakland, Richmond, Fremont, L.A., and all these other urban areas.
So how would you suggest that the members of these communities go about changing this?
And one thing for sure is they can't necessarily wait on the government to conduce them to address these social ills. They have to get together and they have to establish a social agenda, you know, a blueprint of some kind to address the poor, you know, the literate, drug addicts and homeless and other people, especially the unemployed and other deprived people. Without a social agenda, you're just winging. You're improvising. A social agenda is very important, and you'd be surprised what a collective amount of poor people can do together, fighting as one.
What causes you the most concern with regard to the future of the youth in the inner city?
Not being properly or correctly educated. And I say that because the majority of individuals that I've ran into, and myself included one time, we didn't know a thing about our culture. We ended up adopting other people's methods and cultures and things of that nature and their mores. But when it came to our own, we were somewhat bankrupt.
What advice would you offer young people?
Well, depending upon where they are, an education is of the most importance. I keep stressing that because without an education, you can't, put it this way, I've always told individuals that through an education, it leads to a form of being able to reason, a rationale. And through this reasoning and this rationale, a youth can develop a conscience. A conscience comes the form of redemption, being able to reach out to other people and helping those who are less fortunate.
Are you ever disillusioned by what the future may hold for today's youth?
Oh, no. No, no. I'm not a pessimist, nor am I a defeatist. I believe that, what's that term? Dumb sparrow. I breathe, I hope.
Stanley Tukey Williams was interviewed from his prison cell on death row by Dana Granby of Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. And finally, an appeal to the American people to look within our hearts and see that the things that unite us are greater than those that separate us. Teacher, poet, philosopher Rajiv R. Kassat shares his unique recipe for peace.
There is no greater sickness in the world today than the lack of love. Mother Teresa. For a moment, I couldn't even think of a reason not to walk. War is the enemy, a mutual enemy shared by ex-war heroes and draft dodgers. The state of our world has us in constant mobilization. There is no halt to the peace movement. There are no culminating activities and special events we must prepare for. The peace movement must happen every second of every day. It begins in the movements of your lips as they form the words that will be sent to another human being. The peace movement is never ending. In every movement, we must be peace. Of course, I had no reason not to care. I don't believe bombs, tanks, or fighter jets solve problems. This is a democracy, and yes, contrary to public opinion, it is patriotic to express your beliefs. In fact, it would be unpatriotic not to express your feelings of concern and doubt in what could become a third world war. The voice rang loud and apparently angry. But I continued walking as if I should let a little anger stop me. It drove me. But when I took a few moments to breathe deeply, I realized a clear contradiction. I was engulfed by my own self-hatred. I was using the instruments of my oppressors. And in the process, I became exactly that which I hated. Hate. Yes, I walked and I tried to ask other people who were chanting, "Bush, you're a whore. We don't want your oil war. Why are you demonizing the individual? Why are you assassinating his character? Why is it that we get pulled down to their level and in the process become exactly that which we claim opposition? Why do we still not hear Booker T. Washington? Don't ever let them pull you down so low as to hate them. Our peace movement, not yet recalling the full teachings of our prophets, has forgotten that we must love our enemies. So many of my fellow human beings are placing all the blame on Bush, pointing fingers as if he is the cause for all this mayhem, as if he is the only one responsible for the desire of oil. And I thought to myself, if I really care, I'd stop driving my car. So I stopped my verbal abuse and I encouraged those around me who were projecting their hatred to do so as well. I thought perhaps we should all walk in silence. At least, that is, until our broken leg is healed. A broken leg, and where is the cast? If the leg is broken, which apparently it is, shouldn't we not walk on it? Well, the therapy? Are you going to listen to someone who calls you a whore? I know I'm going to put up a wall and not want to hear what comes next out of their mouth. So for every person who understands that peace requires effective and sincere communication, and that without the dialogue we are left stranded in the middle of a battlefield with landmines and insinuations, I ask you again, don't you want him to listen? Don't you want him to hear what you are saying? Because either way, no matter what happens, Bush will be in office for 2 more years, and with that knowledge, wouldn't it be more effective to speak to him as a human being? You see, some may hate him, but the hate that we have for Bush is the same hate he uses to order missiles that will result in the deaths of more human beings. And that hate that we wield for Saddam Hussein is his excuse for continuing to kill his own people. And in the end, we are all beings who are uniquely human. And whether you agree or disagree, mustn't we find it in our hearts to love unconditionally? Even those who may at the moment be contributing more to the violence than alleviating it. No one should be allowed to kill anyone, and I'm not excusing anyone's actions, but in the beginning we were all one day a baby coming out of our mommy's womb, and in the end, even after being behind bars and isolated from ever being able to hurt other people, we must continue living and be shown the light and the error of our ways. Love is the only force that can do this. For no one has passed redemption. Yes, be angry. I'm angry. But let's find a way to channel our anger creatively and lovingly. Let's understand that anger does not allow an individual to think clearly and act effectively. Let's grow together in our movements and embrace some basic principles. If we desire to live with peace on the earth, then we must have compassion for all life. And that does not exclude George Bush or Osama bin Laden. If we desire to bring an end to war, then the only solution is love. And so I submit to you my most heartfelt proposal. Bombs don't solve problems, and really our enemies are but misunderstood friends. We are together in this war, in this celebration, in this amalgamation of reality, placing our egos to the side and living briefly with our hearts open to the dream. Imagine. Not everyone will feel as you feel, but even if we disagree, we still have to live together. That is the reality. So let me say finally, with courage and belief, that I love my parents. No, really, I love you, Mom and Dad. And well, I love my friends also. Just as I love my teacher and that bully on the playground who she saved me from. Yes, could you believe it? I love George W. Bush and I love Osama bin Laden. Both equally, without distinction or reservation. I'll even go as far to say that I love Saddam Hussein and I love Dick Cheney, Ariel Sharon, and Yasser Arafat. And yes, of course, I love you. Each and every one of you. Because really, people are one and the same, and I understand that we have all hurt at one time or another. Yes, I love the winter as much as I love the spring, and I have resolved to love the people that are most hated. And no, there will be no riots. No, we will not damage property. because with our heightened consciousness, we will realize our connection to each other. And no matter what type of violence we're using, the only person that we can destroy is ourselves. By throwing a rock through a window here in Washington, D.C., you are as responsible as any Israeli soldier standing at some checkpoint with a rifle aimed at some child's head, or a suicide bomber taking out three people in a van. By not being nonviolent in our approach, we contradict everything that we claim to support. No, there will be no peace in the world as long as police beat protesters with clubs and protesters call police pigs. But let me return to the beginning. I'm walking in forgiveness. There is a way out of the cycle of violence. There are no enemies. There is, however, a force that paralyzes our evolution. Hatred. And a force that guarantees our existence. Love.
I think the most important thing for us to do is to recognize that inside Bush are parts of ourselves, and inside parts of ourselves are parts of George Bush. Just like anybody who we pass on the street will share traits and characteristics of Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden, there's this idea of separation that really pervades the mentality, I think, of our consciousness right now. And I think the fact that we even could think that we are separate from these human beings who really are the same people in essence as we are is the illusion which keeps us at war. The challenge that I think I've placed on myself before anything is to love myself, because the hatred I have for other people is an inability for myself to love the parts of me that I want to deny.
People listening to this may not quite understand what you mean by parts of George Bush and Saddam Hussein are within me or within you or within everyone. Can you expound on that a bit?
Well, we're really all connected. The parts that I guess I'm talking about are the collective consciousness, which I feel exists. The fact that these people even exist as individuals are because there's a whole mass of people of whom they represent. And those mass of people whom they represent are the parts of us. In other words, they can't exist without us, either chanting hatred towards them, you know, whether we're on the beach somewhere in New Jersey shooting plague guns at posters of Osama bin Laden, or whether we're at a protest, you know, chanting that Bush is a whore. They can't exist without our consciousness allowing them to be. And what I really want is for people to challenge the system and the institution which even gives these people power to begin with. The fact that they can even be making decisions to speak on behalf of so many people when perhaps all these people don't represent what they're saying is, I think, the larger picture. I think we get caught up in pointing fingers. We lose sight of A, our own contribution to the problem, and then B, through pointing fingers, we really forget that those people, those individuals, are not the only people. There are hundreds of other people that exist around them that are supporting them. There's hundreds of other congressmen and women that could be doing things.
One of the things I like about your piece is that you say we can't place all the blame on President Bush. And you say, if I really cared, I'd stop driving my car. Yeah. So when you point fingers, how does it go? You point your finger and four of them are pointing back at you. And so I think that's a part of this puzzle that many of us have not identified and care to respond to the challenge to the individual. You teach high school students in the nation's capital at Woodrow Wilson Senior High alternatives to violence. Is your class an elective? And
yeah.
And who are the students who sign up for your class?
Well, and this is part of where the piece even was given birth, is my work at the high school. The fact that I teach nonviolence and I teach peace in schools requires me to love every student that walks through that door unconditionally.
Tall order.
And on October 26th, we brought over 70 students from Wilson High School to the protest, the National March and rally against the war. And those students that came from the high school really were exposed to a lot of different I guess what you could say, attitudes and angles and strategies of the peace movement. And so what I was basically faced with as a challenge was to find a way to present a solution, you know, to what's happening in a way that is sustainable. I mean, part of what we really recognize in these peace education classes at Wilson High School is that sustainability and security really lies in us creating an environment where everyone feels safe.
Now, you know, looking through your syllabus for your class, I see where you break violence down into three categories: physical, psychological, and structural. And I think we're all pretty much familiar with physical violence and probably psychological too, but give us an example of what you mean by psychological and structural violence.
Well, structural violence is basically when you have medicine sitting in warehouses and pharmaceutical companies. You have tons of medicine that could be being used at this moment to provide children with cures for malaria, or let's say medicines that will prolong people's lives who are living with AIDS. And because people don't have the money to buy the medicine is not going to be used. It stays in the warehouses. People die while they could be receiving the medicine. The medicine goes bad.
Would sanctions against Iraq qualify as structural violence, in your opinion?
Yes. In my opinion, it would. In my humble opinion. The challenge really that we were faced with at the rally was finding a way to approach this situation with love, mm-hmm. you know, and to realize that loving our enemies is the hardest thing to do. And it really begins with loving ourselves. And we all have a responsibility to you know, aid in everybody's growth.
And you're teaching them to love their enemy.
Well, yeah.
And that includes the guy over there in the classroom that's likely to try to steal your tennis shoes or wants to pick a fight with you at the locker. Or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we read Martin Luther King.
How's that going over in your class? How's that class going over?
Tremendous. Tremendous. The class is an elective. We have students, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade students, over 40 students in a class. We have 5 sections of the class being offered at the school. It changes people's lives daily changes everybody's lives. We read everything from Tolstoy to Gandhi to Dorothy Day. Like I was saying, King wrote this amazing essay that was really partly the inspiration to the poem that was just played. Mm-hmm. It's called Loving Your Enemies. Mm-hmm. And that essay, we read that essay and we really spend a lot of time just working on it.
Mm-hmm. What is it about that essay that really inspired you?
Forgiveness. You know, in practicing forgiveness, the hardest thing to do is to forgive someone, you know. And so in terms of the cycle of violence, there's a cycle, you know, that we're stuck in right now. And the only way out of the cycle, to the best of my knowledge, is forgiveness.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch, produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Dred Scott Keys at WBAI, Reem Kathuda, Laurel Paget-Seekins, and Benthe Birkeland. We also had production assistance from Kehinde Garrison. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.